Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello and welcome to the first lockdown edition of The Bunker, Britain's most appropriately slash unfortunately named podcast. I'm Dorian Linsky. On this week's edition, we'll be discussing two big topics. The coronavirus intensifies, countries are sealing themselves off, Donald Trump has finally admitted that something might be up, and according to leaked documents, Public Health England believes 8 million people may be hospitalised. And if COVID-19 is going to change the economy fundamentally, will governments be forced to look again at the idea of a universal basic income? All this and more in this week's edition of The Bunker. Hello, you might notice a slight change in this week's podcast. We're recording from different locations. We hope we won't be on lockdown for too long, but who knows? For now, let's say hello to our guests in their secret locations. Aisha Hazarika is a noted comedian, writer, former Labour spin doctor, and now editor of the Londoner Diary and the Evening Standard. Hi, Aisha.
Hello, Dorian.
How's life for a Londoner Diary?
Well, given that our whole thing is about, you know, what's happening in the night scene in London and going to parties and events, it's proved to be very, very difficult. Literally everything has dried up in terms of socialising and launch parties and things like that. So we're having to be very, very creative.
This year's local London mayor elections have been pushed back to next year. Labour's special conference to announce the new leader is off. There have even been calls to postpone the leadership election entirely. What other changes to the political calendar do you expect to see? Do you think that Parliament will be working from home for any day now?
Well, I think as time is going on, it is actually more and more difficult to make the argument to everybody else to self-isolate, particularly small businesses that can't afford not to. And then Parliament just carries on as before. I mean, they've now stopped external visitors coming in, but everything else is still the same. I mean, we did a wee story in the Diary today. So just as Boris Johnson was saying, you know, everybody change your behaviour, social distance, you know, an MP got into contact with us and said that they walked past the Red Lion, which is the famous pub across the road from Downing Street. It was absolutely heaving. It was heaving all night long with sort of civil servants, special advisors, journalists. So
which night was this?
Just last night.
Last night?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. So I think there's sort of like and staffers, actually, young staffers have been in touch saying we're very confused because everything is carrying on as normal. Yet we're telling everybody else outside Parliament to change their behaviour. So I don't know how sustainable that is.
Well, we'll be talking more about what is and is not sustainable in a bit. Also with us today is Roz Taylor, editor of LSE Brexit. Hi, Roz. Whereabouts are you?
Well, I can't divulge my location, but I can tell you that there's a Darth Vader trying to break through the wall and some very tattered posters of Emperor Palpatine and Stormtroopers. So it's not my normal working location.
You're in Lucasfilm.
That is correct.
Yeah. Well, schools still aren't closed. We've been told to avoid theatres and concerts, but they haven't actually been shut down. I'm not sort of clamouring for a complete shutdown of normal life. But I mean, surely it shouldn't be left to individuals to decide what to do, considering, as we've seen, certain individuals, including the Prime Minister's own father, aren't going to take any of the advice anyway. Are they going to have to make it official very soon?
Yeah, I think they will. I mean, it's wrong for two reasons, really. One, it's completely unfair on the venues themselves, because it's putting the onus on them to decide. And if they need money desperately to survive, it's a very difficult decision. Secondly, it's very difficult with human psychology wants to go out there and have a kind of last gasp. And I think that's what you were seeing almost perhaps in the Red Lion last night. And I think you saw that maybe in the Stereophonics concert, that a lot of people tweeted pictures of the enormous crowds there in Cardiff last weekend. If you have been looking forward to a massive big event with thousands and thousands of people, you know, a part of you is going to say, oh, to hell with it, I'm just going to go. And it's the wrong thing to do, but it's tempting. And so that's the other reason, I think, why it's important to draw a clear line.
Well, you look for signals, don't you? And in that case, you'd look for signals to the promoter or the band to call it off, or to the government to tell you not to go.
Yeah.
But you kind of feel like, well, if it's happening, then it must be okay to go.
Exactly.
And yeah. Of course, it's not okay to go because they play Stereophonics songs.
Also, I just want to pick up something. The Red Line is literally like that every night. Like every night is the last hurrah in politics in terms of like ramming the Red Line and drinking yourself into oblivion.
And also, hello to our guest, Johnny Ross Tatum. Where are you, Johnny?
Hi there. I'm at home this week. So I'm studying part-time at the LSE. And obviously, all classes are cancelled. And I teach part-time in Leeds. And I'm going to go ahead with that later this week, depending on whether schools are still open.
So you're going to be talking to us about UBI, which has been a sort of increasingly hot topic over the last few years. I mean, it's an older idea than that, but it's been discussed more and more all the time. But now you've got Mitt Romney proposing giving every adult American a grand a month during the outbreak. And former Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang, whose big idea this was, now just seems like this kind of prescient, heroic figure. Has it been weird seeing UBI re-enter the conversation in this really dramatic, unexpected way?
I don't think it has been terribly surprising, because, you know, universal basic income is about financial security and making sure people can pay their bills at the end of the month, make sure people can have enough to not have to go to a food bank or not have to go out on the street. But we know that financial insecurity is very widespread in our society. And surveys have shown that nearly 16 million people in the UK have less than £100 in savings. So when events and crises like this happen, it really shines a light on the insecurity that's in our society. And a universal basic income would provide vital relief and security for households across the country, not just in times like this, but at all times.
Well, we're going to talk about that later, and also other measures that the government can take to basically keep people afloat financially. Let's start with the great big coughing elephant in the room. The worst public health crisis for a generation, as Boris Johnson called it, now seems like a massive understatement. Ros, things are moving very fast. Can we rely on people to self-isolate, or do we have are we really seeing kind of human nature in action here? And basically people won't, as we're saying with the gig, but a gig is perhaps a special occasion, and people can you can see why people might want to avoid a massive gathering of Stereophonics fans. But the self-isolation now seems to be moving faster and faster, and now, you know, don't even go to the sort of cafe. Are we really dealing with a communications problem here, that really advice is not enough?
Yes, I think we are. But the problem is ultimately that we don't have the resources to police a massive crackdown of the kind that France has put in place. It's actually interesting, if you listen to what's been happening in France and the address that Macron gave last night, he was saying, look, I told you to start social isolating yourself. And what happened last weekend, you all went out and I saw people celebrating in the streets and there were parties, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, now I'm going to have to crack down. And it's very difficult to do that and to really go in very hard unless you are willing to start putting the army on the streets, unless you have enough police to actually make sure that people stay in their homes. And even then, it's going to be hard, because if you get to the point when you're saying to people, no, you can't go out, a random official is telling you that you can't do that, people are going to kick back enormously against that. I think it's a little bit easier for France in some ways, because it's a more de regis society. I think it is better prepared for that sort of thing. I think in Britain, it will be very hard to enforce this kind of self-isolation. So you have to basically rely on people's sense of duty and obligation to sort of towards society.
And to be blunt, fear.
Yeah.
I mean, I think perhaps that's even more potent than a sense of kind of responsibility.
Yeah, but of course, you're with a fear. I mean, the fear, I think, kicks in if you're in a vulnerable group and perhaps if you're older, though not all older people feel that way. As we've seen in recent days, there's plenty of people saying, well, I'm over 70, but I feel fine and it's not going to affect me. So you shouldn't underestimate the extent to which people can be in denial.
Well, I mean, until yesterday, the UK seemed determined to sort of go its own way compared to the rest of Europe. And, you know, they were asking a lot of trust. They were like, OK, yes, you know, look at Italy and France. We're not doing that. But this is because we have a plan and here are our medical experts. Now that it's changing, do you think the initial strategy was just was totally flawed? Are they adapting to new information, the growth of the virus, or were they in fact wrong from the start, as many people were saying? Because I was unsure.
I was unsure, and I don't think any of us can be sure because we don't know how this is going to play out. It may be, for example, that the sharp crackdowns that we've seen in places like China will have a rebound effect and the virus will just keep on coming back and we won't acquire any kind of enough immunity to prevent possibly years of disruption in our societies. And I don't think anybody knows. It's very hard. I think they were also trying to minimize the economic shock to society in their pronouncements and not to alarm people unnecessarily. And that too, to be fair, is very important because one of the things we're seeing now is people saying, my business is about to go bust, I'm about to be made unemployed. These things have effects. And for all that it is desperately important to protect the most vulnerable people in society, if you shut down society, that has enormous, enormous knock-on effects. And they're not effects that we are used to coping with or thinking about because we haven't had to do that. This is completely new territory. And we're just beginning to discover. It's like a Brexit times 1,000 in terms of the unwanted impacts that are happening.
Yeah. I mean, it makes even the worst case scenario for no deal seem kind of like a minor road bump.
It makes us all nostalgic for Brexit, quite frankly. I mean, I was finding myself thinking I'd kill for a meaningful vote right now. I really would. You know, I miss the Malthouse Compromise. This is what I want to be talking about, not sort of a scene from Contagion.
Oh, God, yeah, totally. I mean, I've had to cut back on Twitter enormously recently because I find it very hard to deal with the spectacle of many, many highly intelligent people desperately seeking confirmation of their hunches and to a certain extent their biases. And there's literally nothing else on Twitter. Whereas before, you know, I was always interested in the minutiae of Brexit and what was going on. It was a lively place. Now it's just fear driving everything.
Well, I saw Niall Horan from One Direction, ex of One Direction, celebrating the fact that his album was very close to going to number one. And I couldn't decide whether this was just an obscenely irrelevant tweet or actually a rather charming reminder of normality, because 99.9% of Twitter is all about one thing.
Well, I mean, I suppose people will be consuming music and content and things like that. So weirdly, I suppose those industries, well, certainly the recorded music side of things will still probably carry on. So in a way, you know, he's probably, in fact, if you're quite savvy, this is quite a good time to promote your music.
Well, it's worked. We've mentioned him on The Bunker.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is going to do it for him, let's be honest.
Like,
I mean, this is
top.
It. He has hit the big time. But I just going back to what Roz was saying about France and this society, I just feel that, like, we are, and this is part of our unique charm as being British, we are so non-deferential. We do not listen to anybody. And because of the last 3 years of Brexit, we're all individual experts in our own mind. We don't need proper experts anymore. We just listen to a phone-in, get our opinions from that, often phone into a phone-in with no knowledge, but, you know, declare ourselves, you know, like a world expert. So, you know, France and Italy, I just think we're slightly differences. I mean, also France are going to stay in because they've got better wine and better cheese, let's be honest. I mean, if I was in France, I'd stay inside the whole time, let's be quite honest. But I do worry, like this whole, you can half in, half out pronouncement from the Prime Minister. I mean, I'm glad that they have given a bit more of a definitive steer and that they have kind of changed course. But at the same time, it's so desperately confusing for people. You shouldn't go out, but you can if you want. And I worry that it's going to be the worst of all worlds. It's going to mean that obviously small businesses, pubs, etc., are going to have a hard time. They'll probably still try and stay open. And at some point, we will all crack after about 4 days, go to the pub. Not huge numbers, but enough to keep spreading the virus and be self-defeating to the original point of doing this.
Well, the government seems to finally realise that paywalled articles and leaking to Peston are no substitute for sort of proper press conferences. But in that kind of, in that period where there wasn't enough official information, it certainly wasn't being explained well enough, people, I saw some wild stuff about herd immunity, which now appears to, we seem to, you know, that seems to have been misexplained, and so we misunderstood it anyway. But some people were seeing it as some kind of like eugenicist plot from Dominic Cummings to sort of cull the population because herd is like cattle, and therefore they're culling us like cattle, and other sort of conspiracy theories. And so has this been a kind of, has part of the problem been that this government is just used to releasing information in kind of, you know, through kind of sneaky leaks and anonymous briefings. And actually what's needed is this very, very old-fashioned speak to the nation daily press conference.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think, first of all, I mean, I'm no fan of this government, but they're not the only government to have used these sneaky ways of leaking things. You know, time immemorial governments have done that. Certainly when I worked, you know, in government, obviously I would never do anything like that. But, you know, it was pretty much, you know, Alistair Campbell had his favourite journalist, his Pestons of the day, if you like. And so that's not unusual. However, And on the flip side, I think what you've just said and what Ross said earlier, that the biases are absolutely off the wall. I mean, this idea, I mean, I've been trying to not engage on Twitter that much over the last couple of days because it has just gone completely batshit. And, you know, there were so many people going, ha ha ha, this is the proof that Boris Johnson wants to execute loads of old people. I mean, there was a hashtag, Boris the Butcher, which, you know, I am no fan of the man, but that is just, for a start, these are the people who vote for him. You know, why is he going to want to sort of kind of exterminate all of these people? So I think everybody, you know, does need to calm down a bit. It is, you know, really quite sensible people I've seen just come up with ridiculous things. But the government has not helped itself in a crisis like this. And it's tough for them, but communication is critical. And what they should have done from day one is establish these press briefings. I'm glad they're happening now. But I also think they have to make sure that they allow the medical and the scientific experts the freedom to really run those press conferences the way they want to and answer the questions they want to, and they're not sort of cowed or hemmed in. So I think where we are is better now, but the comms strategy has been pretty woeful. And as you say, people putting articles behind paywalls, even if it's only just for an hour or 2 hours, you know, we're so thirsty for information at the moment from the government that if anything comes out, you know, we often make our minds up within half an hour of it coming out. So it's those first few moments are kind of golden in terms of getting information out to people.
A big problem too is that this feeds very easily into the austerity narrative. And after 10 years of the government putting into place measures that in many cases, you know, have ensured that poor people suffer as a result, many people, in some ways understandably, jump to the conclusion that they are now putting into place a policy that is going to ensure poor people and disabled people suffer. And it's part of, I've seen a sort of crossover, if you like, between those two narratives, and they've moved very easily between each other. And so that's partly the government's fault, of course, in terms of the things it's said and the way it's behaved in the past and the way that Johnson in particular has abused and broken down our trust in him. And now he suddenly wants it. And so I do get why people think, well, why the hell should I believe you now?
Well, he's coming out and it's sort of trust in me, trust the experts, and he's a hard pitch man for that idea.
He's not exactly a trusted narrator in terms of, you know, dealing with something of this magnitude. Yes, he's been the sort of showboater that took a huge gamble on Brexit and it paid off. For him in the short term, it's paid off. But yeah, you're right. He's not a trusted narrator on this. I mean, I found I've had to think very, very carefully about reining in my obvious tribalism on this, because I am no fan of this government, but I want them to succeed right now because we all need them to succeed in terms of how this goes forward. But yeah, I mean, Roz, you are right. It's hard for people to trust in them because of their past record. I mean, this could actually be an opportunity for Boris Johnson. You know, often big crises are in some ways, like, believe it or not, good for premierships. It gives you something to define yourself by. You know, you can put your shoulder to the wheel, you can try and be this kind of father of the nation type figure, show everybody that you're straining every sinew to look after your citizens and all this stuff. But I think that because they have really bungled the comms in this critical first week, and because of the very brutal backdrop of 10 years of austerity and, you know, quite kind of and still not really kind of getting that, people are worried. But I just think the big thing they've shot themselves in the foot on is this very kind of confused information about businesses and businesses staying open, yet people not going to them. I think this is something which is really, really going to damage them, given that they are meant to be the party of business, given that they just won a huge majority saying to the country, by the way, we're not the party of big business, we're the party of the little guy, we're the party of the people that are going to listen to you, your kind of small operations, sometimes one-man band, 2, 3, 4 people in your company, we're rooting for you. Now, it shows that it's a completely different story.
Roz, the supermarkets have said that that their no deal kind of wargaming has actually helped them with this, and they're constantly
not according to the scenes I saw in Sainsbury's this morning, hasn't. But anyway,
well, they are constantly saying we have got this is the problem, that for the supermarkets they've kind of worked out how to keep the supply chains going. I mean, not indefinitely, but certainly for now. But perhaps what the message of no deal kind of planning has sent to average shoppers is stockpile. And so people are kind of stockpiling in quite sort of a run. Like, no one's told them to stockpile. Nobody has said, oh, we're going to run out of toilet paper and pasta. This was obviously before any sort of talk of a lockdown. So I just wondered whether somehow we've sort of trained people to be ready to stockpile. All those jokes about lentils and big bags of rice we made on Romaniacs have brainwashed the nation.
Yeah, it makes you realise as well how relatively few people must have been stockpiling for Brexit, presumably because so many people thought it was a good idea compared to now, when everyone is literally piling in. I also think that there's a lot of confusion about the stockpiling. I mean, not to return too much to the subject of loo roll, but don't stockpile loo roll. You're not going to need loo roll when things get really bad. Honestly, you're not. It's not going to be your first concern. And I find
you might need some loo roll.
No, you won't. Because so, you know,
somewhere between 0 and 50 rolls.
If you've got a shower, then you can always handle these problems without wanting to get into too. It's not an imperative. And I think there's almost a sort of parody of stockpiling, and it's just taken off by itself. It bears no relation to what is actually useful in the event of a crisis.
Johnny, this crisis seems to have inspired kind of a range of responses from people. There's been huge acts of spontaneous kindness, donations to food banks, Sally Hughes beauty banks, people offering to do the shopping for vulnerable neighbours. And then, of course, scenes of absolute disaster movie carnage
in Asda and Lidl. And what's been your experience so far in terms of how the public are behaving?
I think it's a mix, and we don't quite know the full scale of it. There's definitely a lot of fear and anxiety, though, because, you know, this virus isn't just going to affect people who contract the virus. It's not just going to affect people who have to stay at home because they're self-isolating. It's likely to affect all of us. You know, I've talked to lots of people who are worried about being laid off because their small business that they work for relies on events that are being cancelled. A lot of sole traders are understandably worried that their income is going to be a shot due to this crisis. So there's lots of people worried about what's going to happen, and so it's kind of it's likely that there is going to be some panic. But most of the people I've spoke to and the people I've seen are, you know, just determined to get through this really, and hope that the government and society will support them to do it.
This is kind of, you know, ground zero of British kleptocracy.
They say power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I'm Brian Kloss, the host of Power Corrupts. Come explore the dark side of power on topics ranging from propaganda to conspiracy theories, mercenaries to biological warfare, and money laundering to election rigging.
If you tell a small truth, sometimes you will accept a bigger lie.
Subscribe now to Power Corrupts, wherever you listen to podcasts.
However long this crisis lasts, people still need to get paid. How do you ensure people have enough to live on and resuscitate the economy after what will probably be the biggest economic shock since the Second World War? The idea of universal basic income, UBI, has been dismissed as utopian in the past, but could it have a central role to play in a post-COVID working world? To explain more, we have founder of the Buchanan Institute, Scotland's first student-led think tank, and ambassador for Basic Income North. We heard from him earlier. Hello again, Johnny Ross Tatum.
Hello, Dorian. Thanks for having me on the show.
So, well, it's a pleasure. First up, can you give us the idiot's guide to UBI? What is the basic concept?
So a universal basic income is a payment to everybody, a regular payment to everybody, regardless of income. It works in a very similar way to the basic state pension and a very similar way to the child benefit. And the idea is that it reduces poverty, increases economic security, and gives a income boost for the majority of people. The highest earners in most models will essentially pay their UBI payments back intact, so it doesn't enrich Premier League footballers, but it should give an income boost to the majority, reduce poverty, and provide that vital economic security, which would be really crucial for many households at this time during COVID, but also in other times as well.
And supporters of UBI range from kind of utopian socialists to Silicon Valley libertarians and it's people, you know, on the right. How does it bring all these people together? Do they mean different things by it, or are they approaching effectively the same policy but from kind of different angles? It's very rare to find a policy that kind of attracts love from across the spectrum.
It is rare, and it always has done, actually. I think, you know, it's been supported by Martin Luther King. It's been supported by people like Milton Friedman. So it's always had support from across the political spectrum. I think it's gaining traction now because the challenges we're facing with economic insecurity are very widespread. And some people are supporting it because they can see the threat of automation. But economic insecurity and the need to increase and strengthen security for families and households is a need right now. So that's why I think its support for it is building across the political spectrum. And that seems to be accelerating further with a crisis like COVID, because it is shone a torch on how insecure many of us are, and actually how inadequate the safety net is, particularly in this country after 10 years of austerity.
Where in the world has it been put into practice or even road tested, and what kind of results have we seen?
It's been trialled in many different countries, and the trials have been almost universally successful. Trials in Canada in the 1970s, for instance, found that with better financial security, people were actually healthier, and it reduced the stresses associated with financial insecurity. People were less likely to go to hospital on account of physical or mental illnesses. And this was then backed up by the recent trial in Finland. And in some cases, given particularly women more power to leave abusive relationships because they're no longer reliant on their partners for their survival. One point that lots of people might say is, well, if you give people an unconditional income, like a UBI, universal basic income, it'll stop people working. There hasn't been any trials around the world where people have worked less with a universal basic income. People will still work with this payment. They'll just have more money and more financial security. And that has significant benefits for health, but also for local economies.
And how expensive would it be? Because I suppose a lot of people who maybe haven't, you know, done the reading on this, their initial instinct is just like, well, how can the government afford to give X billion pounds away to people? What's the kind of the funding model for it?
Well, generally, there's a variety of proposals in the UK that have been done by economists and think tanks. And generally in the UK, the proposals for a UBI range from, at the lower end, £50 a week for an adult, upwards to £120 a week, and an amount about £40 to £60 a week for children, and also a higher amount for pensioners. And variety of proposals have shown there are ways of funding this fairly and progressively through progressive income tax, so higher earners essentially pay their basic income back in tax. But also you've got many other areas. You've got over 1,000 tax loopholes that disproportionately benefit the wealthiest. You could close some of those. You could also look at a carbon tax, which is vital for tackling the climate emergency, but also you could distribute that revenue to everybody through a universal basic income. Indeed, that is actually supported by people like William Hague and Alistair Darling, people in the Conservative and the Labour Party. And you've also got another option, which they tried in Alaska, which is set up a sovereign wealth fund and over time pay dividends out from that sovereign wealth fund to everybody individually, which is how they funded a modest universal basic income in Alaska.
Aisha, you worked very closely with Ed Miliband. He's come out as a prominent supporter of UBI. Was this something that he talked about when you worked together? Is this a sort of relatively recent fascination for him?
I think it was something that he agreed with sort of privately, but that's not where the political zeitgeist was. And I suppose where I would probably slightly disagree with Johnny is that this has been a universally popular idea for a long time. I think up until quite recently, I think people were, or even on some parts of the left, were a bit sceptical about this idea. I think nobody... there's lots of evidence to say that, you know, people's physical health and mental health could be sort of benefited. I was interested about the Finland study. I mean, I've been reading up on the Finland study. My impression was slightly less positive in terms of productivity. It certainly didn't really show that people dropped out of work, but it didn't show that people kind of were more productive with their work or upskilled. And I think one of the things that a lot of people, particularly on the left, have criticised UBI for is that it isn't maybe the panacea to what are already quite deep structural problems in the economy. For example, the gender pay gap, the lack of childcare that keeps people back, or lack of social care, the issues of sick pay. I mean, I think it's very interesting when someone like Mark Zuckerberg pronounces that we should have a universal basic income, but he won't pay his tax properly through Facebook. So there's lots of other things that need to be closed up. However, I think it's an idea that may have found its time in this emergency coronavirus situation. It's interesting that Andrew Yang, who was one of the US presidential candidates for 2020, he proposed a universal basic income and sort of got laughed at. And now it's something that the government in America is indeed, you know, possibly looking at as a short-term economic emergency measure to tide people over. So it could be something that in the short term is adopted. But also, it is very important to encourage people that, you know, work is important. And, you know, there's some on the left that say, oh no, we're going to live in this sort of era of abundance where artificial intelligence and robots and automation means that all the work's going to be done, so we can just like kick back and like write poetry the whole time and things. But we know that world is sadly not coming, and actually people will still have to work, and we have to make sure that and work also brings kind of big positive mental health things, even all of us being cooped up for one day or missing our work colleagues and wanting some human interaction. So I think it's got some really, really interesting prospects in the short term. And I think this could be the big policy that really, really takes off as a result of this crisis. But whether it becomes a long-term staple of our society, I'm not so sure.
So for me and many advocates of a universal basic income, this isn't about replacing work. This is about providing extra income and security, and particularly for the majority of households across the country. And it's not a panacea for all ills. We need good quality work. We need good quality public services. But we are in a situation, as I said before, where 16 million people have less than £100 in savings, and nearly 40% of workers have less than £1,000 in savings. So one unexpected payment away from debt. So we need to find ways of increasing economic security for people across this country. And a universal basic income could be one part of that, as well as investing in well-paid jobs through tackling climate change and other policies.
So, Roz, I've seen people pointing out that if it's inhumane, to disconnect people's water or to evict them for one missed payment, if it's sort of a sign of a rather callous society that so many people are, so close to the precipice, just sort of one kind of paycheck away from it, then if you can have UBI and if you can have emergency measures during the crisis, why not have them afterwards? And obviously we've seen before, the many wartime measures, they actually acclimatize citizens to getting certain sort of help from the state, which then carries on into the post-war world. I mean, I don't know whether it be UBI or something else, but do you expect that we will actually see that some of these emergency measures may well become long-term?
Yeah, I think that's quite possible. I think as more people experience precarity and experience what it's like to be uncertain about the future, as they will in the next few months, it may develop a more, if you like, compassionate mindset in which they're open to the idea of, that it's not just, we're not living in an atavistic society where we're all just scrabbling to keep afloat, but the state actually can do something to keep everybody afloat. And if, particularly if the government does actually manage, and I hope it, obviously, desperately, it does manage to prevent the worst, the worst effects of the coronavirus happening, that they might have more trust in the ability of government to actually change their lives for the better, as opposed to the very American view, which is that you cannot rely on government, you must always be self-sufficient. That is the way forward. So I think there could be a step change in thinking, optimistically.
And Rishi Sunak's budget, which feels like it was roughly 1,000 years ago, was a partial response to sort of early stages of the crisis. Now it's like we're definitely going into a post-austerity period for a while. There's probably going to have to be a sort of crisis budget soon. Do you think that the government is going to have to be involved in kind of degrees of state intervention that Jeremy Corbyn would never have dared suggest, there is just no time now for your kind of traditional conservative hands-off free market ideology?
Yes, this is a difficult sell for conservatives, clearly, because the idea of free handouts is anathema to much conservative thinking. But there is another way of looking at it, which is that in a UBI would reduce red tape and bureaucracy, which we also know that Conservatives hate. It was one of the big selling points of Brexit, ironically, given it's quite the reverse, but that European red tape would be removed. And also Johnson in particular, I mean, populists like catch-all, easily understood measures. We've seen in Eastern Europe, people like Viktor Orban handing out sums of money, for example, if you have a certain number of children. And those are very easy for the public to understand. Similarly, a UBI would be very easy for everyone to understand, and it has that advantage in populist terms. The risk, I think, when conservative governments implement this, is that you see a reining in of other benefits, which is justified by the introduction of UBI. So they say, oh, well, we don't need to provide this anymore because everyone has this basic income, so we don't need to provide the basics anymore. And that might start to happen, particularly in the years after one was introduced.
Aisha, what do you think we're going to see from the Chancellor?
Well, I think I think that he is going to have to really revise his budget. I mean, his budget that he unveiled to much fanfare last week really feels like it was a different time. And I think a lot of spending might have to be slightly deferred. I think they're going to have to increase a lot of, you know, day-to-day spending, which was not really in the plan. A lot of the last budget was future spending and borrowing for future infrastructure projects. And I just feel that I do agree with Rose that this would be a very easy kind of virtue signal thing for them to do. And it would also be the right thing to do to give people some comfort at this time. You know, there's so many, the government's getting absolutely hammered at the moment about freelancers and the self-employed, you know, the people who are meant to be the backbone of the economy because, you know, they're seeing all their income falling away. So this would be, it's a good PR move for them and it's the right thing to do. But I think we do have to sort of get real about the long-term consequences of it. You know, as Ross said, what they give with one hand, they would more than likely take with the other. So they would get a huge amount of, you know, great press and the tabloid press, the right-wing press, etc., saying, hooray, hooray, this is this, you know, fabulous thing. But what would we find down the track? You know, tax credits will probably be cutting back. We know universal credit is already really, really difficult. And there was no extra money put in that in the budget last week. Housing allowances, which have already been trimmed back, could be cut even more. So I don't believe that this government has had a completely ideological shift. And I don't believe it will have a completely ideological shift. I think they're being pretty ruthlessly pragmatic for political reasons and because of, you know, the sort of drama that's right in front of us. But I think it's naive to think that, you know, going, you know, if we get through this, that they would commit to having this. It just goes against every sort of principle that they don't really believe in giving free stuff out to everybody. We had a huge amount of controversy over cutting back of child benefit to just two children. They were just on the brink of axing free television licenses to the over 75s. That's had a stay of execution because of the coronavirus. So this is not a government, even with this slightly more populist man in charge, this is not a government which like loves giving stuff away for free. And also, we are not a public which actually loves giving stuff away for free. I mean, let's remember the Labour manifesto had loads of goodies that people were well, you know, briefed on, from free broadband, and the public sort of rejected that. We also talk about people being more compassionate, but I hate to go back to loo rolls. I think the whole loo roll and pasta saga has shown us that we are not living in some kind of compassionate nirvana yet, unfortunately.
In the short term, former US Treasury Secretary Larry Summers put it well. There's the difference between economic time and financial time, and economics, obviously, the machinery of the economy. But even if that stops, financial time, which is having to pay kind of rent, mortgage, insurance, etc., bills, that goes on. It's basically when the two become disconnected, you have huge problems. Now, I've seen already it's happening here, it's happening in the States. There are mortgage payment holidays. There are moratoriums on rent and utility bills. People are not being punished if they can't make payments. But it seems that this is being done by individual banks and companies. And I wonder, you know, things are moving fast, like we said. Does the government have to kind of come up with a big plan to reassure people who are worried in numerous sectors that they're just not going to be able to afford to pay the bills?
No, we can't leave it to the private sector alone. We need to have very clear information from the government on how they're going to support people, as France has been doing with guarantees that paying bills for utilities in particular will be halted. And it's been very clear on those things. It's made sure that nobody will lose their job as a result of the coronavirus. While culturally, Britain is not set up to do that, I think it is something that people are going to be more and more clamouring for in the coming months. And to return to the idea of a universal basic income, if you want a flexible workforce, if you want people, if you're going to expose people to these kind of risks, and you're going to say that they may be out of work 1 month, but then back in work another month, and that may be the case for the next few months or so, as people are perhaps rehired and maybe even sacked again as there's a second wave or third wave of a virus, there will be so much uncertainty that the government really has a big role to play in providing them with a degree of certainty about their ability to carry on functioning.
Johnny, the last time I was reading about universal basic income in detail was in the context of kind of the post-work world, Daniel Susskind's recent book. Now, a lot of people are getting used to working from home, sort of homeschooling, you know, obviously working different hours. But do you think that UBI will play a role in rebuilding the world of work when we get back to normal?
In terms of this crisis, I've been arguing for having a UBI permanently, but in terms of this crisis, we need something right now, immediately, to put money into people's hands to support households and the economy during this crisis. So we need an emergency UBI right now to go straight into people's budgets, into people's bank accounts, and to support them during this crisis. But after the crisis, it will provide vital security for many people going when they go back into work.
We've come to the end of the podcast, which is when we usually ask the panel for their escape routes from politics. But now we're all locked in our own rooms, the question of which music, TV, books or movies we're relying on takes on a new relevance. Johnny, as our guest, we'll start with you. What is your very necessary happy place?
Oh, I think...
What's distracting you?
Going to the park, if we are allowed out in this crisis, going to the park and having a walk or a run outside.
Imagine if you've been escorted by a bobby back from the park and told you cannot leave the house. Is there like a TV show or a book or something you escape into when you're on lockdown?
I think just watching a series with my partner, just on our sofa. That'll be an escape.
That sounds good. Aisha, how about you?
I've actually been quite enjoying the early part of this lockdown just because it's giving me an excuse to binge outrageously. So the thing I have binged on, and I absolutely love it and I make no apologies for it, it's called Love is Blind on Netflix, and it's the most deranged show I've ever seen. It's like Love Island, but on steroids. And at first I was like, oh, this is terrible. And then I'm like completely sort of sucked into it. So that has been my guilty pleasure. And I've also been watching, I haven't finished it yet, but I've been watching Noughts and Crosses on the BBC iPlayer, which is really good as well.
Roz, how about you?
Well, I'm a bit late to this, but I've just discovered the Rule of Three podcast, which Aisha probably knows about, but I didn't. And it's very, very good value. So it's a comedian every week talking to a couple of other comedians about their favourite bits of comedy. And the one I've really enjoyed in the last few days has been Nadia Shireen talking about the glory of smash hits in its heyday. Well, it doesn't exist anymore, so this will be in the 80s. And just how funny that was. But there's a huge range of just comedians talking about comedy. It's just fantastic. So I highly recommend that.
So I've got two things. One is the trip to Greece, because we're not able to take a trip anywhere. And normally you watch Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon in these picturesque locations and feel envious. But now it's just like science fiction. So it's like, oh, my God, look, they're going to restaurants and they're sitting very close to each other. And it just feels like it's sort of rather poignant. And, of course, it's very funny and they do all the impressions. And there's another thing. It's a podcast episode called The Case of the Missing Hit on a regular podcast called Reply All. And it's so incredibly trivial. It's just somebody who remembers, swears that he can remember a song, like literally every melody, every word, a song from the 90s, but can't find any evidence of it online. It's as if it's been wiped from history. And the whole thing is like an hour long, incredibly dogged investigation to find out what happened to this hit. Did it ever exist? And if so, why does nobody else remember it? And it's just a kind of delightfully trivial, compelling distraction. And that's the end of this week's Bunker. Thanks very much to our long-distance panel, Johnny Ross Tatum, Aisha Hazarika, and Roz Taylor. We will be back in some form next week. Subscribe to The Bunker on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Twitter at bunker_pod. Thanks for listening. See you next week and take care.
The Bunker was presented by Dorian Linsky, Ross Taylor and Aisha Hazarika. Audio production was by me, Alex Rees. The assistant producer is Jacob Archbold and the producer is Andrew Harrison. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.